Accession number 28198, Reel 1.
Well, I suppose my earliest recollections are of Ayr, where I was born in 1895, and I don't have any memories of it except one visit that my mother took me back to show the house I was born in. And when I believe I was about 3 months old, my father, who was in the Inland Revenue Department, was moved to Aberdeen, where we lived at 7 Marine Terrace, which was on top of a hill overlooking Aberdeen Harbour. I have a few vivid memories of living there. It was a road, the inland side of which were huge three-story granite houses. We were number 7. I think there were perhaps another 4 or 5 houses before the end of the road, and the side opposite the houses were steep gardens which were fenced in and led down to the road that led into the town of Aberdeen. I remember having faint recollections of going to a kindergarten school in Duthie Park Road, which was an extension of Marine Terrace beyond the fork of the road that led down to the town of Aberdeen. And I have vivid recollections in, I suppose it must have been about 1899 or 1900, as a very small boy in a kilt, seeing the train that carried Queen Victoria away from Aberdeen after her visit at that period. And according to my mother, I was waving a Union Jack at the train as it passed over the bridge over the entrance to Duthie Park. And according to the report, the Queen waved back to me, which I strongly doubt. I have recollections too of the early days of the Boer War, when my eldest brother, much against the will of my parents, enlisted in the Scottish Horse, and he was in South Africa for the Boer War, and I had enough interest in it to remember a few things about it, one of which was on the occasion of the relief of Mafeking. All the trawlers in Aberdeen Harbour let fly with their sirens and kicked up an awful row. And at the time I was upstairs with Mother and asked her what it was about, and she told me that Mafeking had been relieved, and I had sufficient knowledge of it to be excited, and I rushed downstairs to the hall, where we kept a large brass dinner bell under the hall stand, which I rang and rang and rang and rang and wouldn't stop until Mother rushed downstairs after me and stopped me forcibly. The only relations I remember in Scotland were my grandfather and grandmother and couple of my uncles. My grandfather had been manager of a bank in Leipzig and had retired, and his eldest son, my Uncle John, was the current manager. The other uncle I remember was an Uncle Archie who had also been in the Boer War and been taken a prisoner and had been released at the end of... No, that can't be right. Anyway, he got away and...
escaped or something. Were there any sort of things like new first motor cars in Scotland, were they?
No, first motor car I ever saw was in South Norwood when we moved there. Oh, yeah. Bloke walking up the road with a red flag followed by a motor car.
Yeah, 15 miles an hour. So you left Aberdeen when you were, what, about four or something, did you?
Left Aberdeen when... I must have been five. I think we went to Belfast. I have a vague recollection of my father stumping around saying 1900 or something. So I must have been five when we got to Belfast. And then we were about a year in Belfast or possibly more. And... one of my brothers had typhoid and the other had pleurisy at the same time, and I stopped going to school because there was nobody to make me go to school. And then I started again in South Norwood, where my eldest brother came home from the Boer War when we were in Norwood. I suppose I must have been six or so there. Five or six. I went to a dame school there for a bit.
You remember what was the streets in Norwood you lived? Do you remember that?
Yes, Auckland Ruin, number 16 Auckland Road, South Norwood.
That was somewhere near Whitgift, was it? Or?
No, it's a long way from Whitgift. I used to rode a bike. Wouldn't just find you used to travel, go to walk to South Norwood Station, catch a train to East Croydon, and walk there. And my great friend there was an Arthur Yates, whose father was the editor of the Queen's Magazine.
What was the Queen's Magazine? Is
that a... Oh, you've seen the Queen, surely, Christmas time. One of these things that. Big coloured front page.
Illustrated London News, is
that? Yeah, like that sort of paper, yes. Mm. I was very keen at school. The only thing I was really keen on were the cadet corps, now called Officers Training Corps, which I took a great interest in and worked hard and passed sundry military examinations, and I always had an ambition to be in the army. But in those days, of course, it was considered impossible to get a commission in the army unless you had substantial private means, which I hadn't.
Well, you had to buy a commission, did you?
No, you didn't have to buy a commission, but you had the private means to. So I thought that when I'd passed an examination called Certificate A, which qualified you for a commission as a second lieutenant in the Territorial Army, I would wait until a war came along and join up. And then for employment, I went into the Eastern Telegraph Service, which after years training in London, I went to Marseilles in the south of France as a submarine telegraph operator. And that was in June 1912, I think, as far as I recollect. And in due course, of course, the war started in 1914, and in the telegraph service at that time there was great agitation because France had already declared war, and everybody wanted to know if England was going to declare war on Germany. And we knew about 12 hours before the general public war had been declared, and it was very hard to keep it under your hat. And I remember in a cafe, I was with some friends in a cafe in the Canebière in Marseilles, when a man who represented himself as being a newspaper correspondent of the Telegraph came along and accosted one of my friends at the table and asked him if he was correct in assuming he was one of the Eastern Telegraph staff, cable staff. And when he was told he was, he tried to winkle information out of him as to whether England had declared war about 6 or 7 hours before it was publicly known, which he failed to do and very nearly got flattened for his trouble. I was on night duty at Marseilles, which, as I said before, only the main line was open, working at that time, and it was winter's night, and there was, at the far end of the office, I was on the receiving on the mainline cable, and there was nothing coming through on the tape, and I used to wander about from the instrument to the fire at the end of the room where the supervisor on night duty was one of the senior French local clerk, and warm myself at the fire and walk back to my instrument and wind up some more tape to see if there was anything on it. And this occasion I wandered back to the fire and the supervisor was away from his desk, so I sat in his. He was a Mr. Sarianelli, and he came back very roughly to me to get out of his chair, and I got out and apologized. And he went on abusing me. Sarianelli, I've said I'm sorry. I won't sit in your chair again. And he still wouldn't stop abusing me. For that, now stop it. I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to say any more. And he said, oh? He said, what'll you do? I said, I'll show you outside the office if you don't stop very quickly. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, come outside the office and I'll show you. He said, you're a coward. Just like that. I said, Mr. Sarianelli, never call an Englishman a coward. He said, I will, you're a coward. And I hit him. Terrific smack, right in the office with all the staff looking on. He went flat down his back underneath his desk. I dragged him up and I said, now come outside to the change room. I took him out and my friend Collins, who was a Cornishman, came with us, and Mr. Sarianelli hadn't a chance. He's a much bigger man than I was, and he had over fighting. And I pounded him, and Collins and I, after he'd departed with a very black eye, thought, well, there's going to be a hell of a row about this. And in the morning, I was sent for to see the superintendent. The assistant superintendent was in the office, and the superintendent told me that Mr. Sarianelli had tell them that I had assaulted them in the office? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, why? I said, Mr. Serenelli called me a coward, and I said that it was a very wrong thing for a Frenchman to call an Englishman a coward, and he wasn't to do it, and he called me a coward again, I'll hit him again. So that stumped the superintendent. He's a terrible black eye. If he goes sick, what the devil am I to say in the sick report? That was the last I heard of it, of course. It really was funny. I thought I was very patient. I mean, damn it. I gave him a chance. He spoke very good English, but I just thought it's fair to give him a warning not to do a second time. While I was at Marseilles, of course, we got all the latest war news on the cables. And one night, when I was on night duty, which was from midnight till 6 o'clock in the morning, we had two cables in the Marseilles office, which by agreement with the French government had to be landed at a place called Bona, which is on the African coast, immediately opposite Marseilles. And there were two cables. The main one worked continually through to Malta, and the second one, although it went through Bona, and Bona came in on it occasionally, it was shut down in the evening about 8 o'clock and not used again. And one night when I was on the mainline circuit and there was no traffic coming through, I walked across and I noticed that the second line that was shut down is agitating violently, so I turned it on and I found it was a signal from Bona calling Marseilles. So I answered the call and they sent a super urgent service message through saying that a four-funnel cruiser was bombarding Bona, and this turned out to be the Goeben, one of two ships, the Goeben and the Breslau, that had escaped from Dardanelles or someplace and had escaped into the Mediterranean. So then was a terrific panic in the office. We had to call the superintendent, who was in his hotel some distance away, to come to the office, and he contacted French authorities, and eventually a telegram was sent to Toulon that the Goeben and the Breslau were at loose in the Mediterranean.
Oh, nobody knew before that they were on the loose. That was the sort of first...
Well, I suppose naval authorities on base may have done. And then later on at Suez, of course, we had the excitement of the Emden and the Karlsruhe, I think the ship was called. The Karlsruhe escaped up a West African river, and the Emden, as everybody knows, sent a crew to wreck the station there. Well, Cocos Islands was in direct contact on the main line through us, and at the station at Suez, Cocos suddenly stopped all traffic and said that there was a four-funnel cruiser, which was the disguised Emden. I think the Emden had three funnels and they put another one up too. And approaching the island, then there was another service message that a boat's crew was approaching. Boat's crew landed and then silence. Well, unfortunately for the Emden, the boat's crew may have been very enthusiastic, but they weren't very efficient, and they did a frightful lot of damage in smashing things, but they didn't take very effective means of stopping telegraphic communications. I mean, they they dug up the cable on the beach and cut it, and they smashed all the telegraph instruments with sledgehammers. But the chief engineer at Cocos Islands had buried parts of telegraph instruments all over the place, and within a matter of, I don't remember now, a few hours, Cocos was in communication with Singapore, and the cable ship loaded with a complete new station had departed from Singapore to Cocos Islands before the Emden's boat crew had got back to their own ship. And then I had written a letter of resignation to the Eastern Telegraph Companies. I wanted to join the army, and was politely told that I was working on business of national importance. I was not allowed to join, much to my indignation, as my two brothers and all my school friends were already in the army, and I was very disgusted. And on Christmas Eve 1914, I was transferred to the cable station at Suez, and as we had had a mistral blowing in the Mediterranean for some days previous, it was an exceedingly rough passage. One other member of the staff from Marseilles came with me, and we shared a cabin in the Messagerie Maritime boat. And during the night preceding Christmas Day, we were in a most terrific storm. My cabin companion nearly died of seasickness, and I was flooded out of my bed from a leaky porthole above it. And when the steward came along to change my bed, a huge wave smashed the companionway door in that was opposite our cabin entrance and swept him down the corridor in my relay bedding. And on Christmas Day, I had the pleasure of being the only passenger on the boat who was up that I saw. And when we got to the Suez Canal, we had a very slow passage through, as there was a continual passage of troop ships going north to engage in the war in Europe. And we saw trenches on the west bank of the canal already manned by Indian and British troops. And on arrival at Suez, we found that the camp there was under the command of, I think at that time, of General Townsend, later of Kutch fame. And there were a lot of English territorial army there, many of whom were at school with me, which I visited in the Suez camp. And later on, of course, when the Turks attacked from the Attica Mountains to the east, from the rooftop of the mess building in Suez, we could see the gunfire and even on occasions the flashes of rifle fire at night, which made me and others particularly discontented. And there were a number of desertions from the staff, one of whom was myself. I decided that I tried to get a passport to go home, which was refused by the British consul. But then I discovered another trick that the police, the officer in charge of the police at Suez, could give you a permit to go through the canal by boat. So I got a permit from the police to go to Portside, and when I got to Portside, I rushed down to the consul at Portside, who didn't know me, told him a pack of lies, and got a passport to go back to England, and left a false trail with the head boy in the mess at Suez to let him know in strict confidence, which he wasn't to pass on, that I was going south with a convoy of British troops who were going to East Africa.
Of course, you put it there.
That's what I told him.
What happened when you got back out to Suez? You joined up straight away, did you?
When I got back from Suez, well, I applied for a commission, and it was refused on the grounds of the Eastern Telegraph Company must have warned the War Office. It was refused on the grounds of my having left work of national importance without permission. So Nigel, my brother Nigel, was in the HAC. I went and joined the HAC.
You trained in England, did you?
Trained in England for three. I got away with 3 months training instead of six because I had all my efficiency papers from the school cadet corps. Went to France. Oh, there's another little anecdote that might be amusing. The HAC were, 1st Battalion and the HAC were GHQ troops out of the line doing guards at GHQ at a place called Montreuil, which was a walled town, and we had various guards. There was a guard at the citadel, an anti-aircraft guard at the citadel, which had a go at a zeppelin, and there were guards at three gates into the town. The gate guards were double sentry posts, one each side of the road, of the guard room, and very strict and complicated orders about numbers of cars that could pass at all times, and cars that could pass when they were flying their flag, but not when it was furled. And these, unlike the sentries at Buckingham Palace, take a board out of the sentry box and read it. We had to know it off by heart. And on this particular occasion that I was going to tell you about, we'd had many, many attempts to trick us by the provost marshals. Minions, you know, trying to get out without showing a purse or a wrong purse or a misdated purse or something like that. So we were always meticulously careful. And this particular occasion, I was on guard on the side of the road of the incoming traffic. And the car flying a flag that passed the driver in the car but not the occupant came up on my side of the road, and I stopped him, and he showed me his appropriate, the driver showed me his appropriate pass. I said, "Has your passenger got a pass?" And he said, I don't know. So I had to step round, open the door, and it was a general. So I saluted smartly and said, "May I see your pass, sir?" And he said, "I had got birth." And I said, "I'm very sorry, sir. I'm afraid you can't go through." And he was very nice about it. He said, "Well, and General Birdwood, and that is just after Gallipoli. And General Birdwood, I'm dining at the CNC at 1 o'clock. It was then about 1:20. And I said, I'm very sorry, sir, the Sergeant Major, I didn't say that to General Birdwood, I said, the Sergeant Major, they said, I don't care if you're God Almighty, you know, because you had a pass. So I said, I'm very sorry, sir. And he said, could I see the Sergeant of the Guard? I said, yes, sir. And he came out of his car and I marched him smartly up to the guard room. There's a French customs post first and the guard room's around the other side. What a laugh there. General Bird was walking up the road, the CGC was slipped round marching behind him. Yelled for the Sergeant of the Guard. He came out and saw him, you see, and nothing he could do about it. He went rushed back into the guard room and rang up the provost marshal at GHQ, you see, and she said, God sake, let General Birdwood through. So CGC marched him back to his car and saluted smartly and saw him off. There are all sorts of things. On another occasion, two officers in a sports car rushed out, came slap down the centre of the road. He was trying to split it between the bloke the other side of the road and himself. So he'd signalled, he'd seen them coming before I had, and signalled them to stop, and they didn't. So as they came opposite me, I pushed one up the spout and said, halt or I fire, at the top of my voice. He never saw a car stop so quickly. I would have had a smack at the car if they hadn't stopped. And of course there was a third man down the road that had got them anyway. And then there was the Lewis gun guard on top of the citadel, which was on one of the walls of the town. And every night for a week we had a Zeppelin coming over. And we had strict orders not to fire at it unless it started dropping.